I'm very happy to be here, and I'm very thankful to Boris for inviting me. And actually, I spent a couple of years here with Gunter doing nice pattern formation experiments, and this is a little beyond what we've done in those days, but I'm glad to see that, well, maybe Gunter would actually disagree with that. Yes, that's right. But at any rate, it's very nice to be back in Santa Barbara. Having a great time. So this is another experiment using cryogenic helium gas. We actually don't do, haven't made measurements in liquid, but this is the work that's done at the University of Oregon. And then my colleague, Ladik Skrbek, is here in attendance, and then Professors Srinivasan and Donnelly, Srinivasan at Yale, are the other collaborators. Well, let me give a little bit of history, because our motivation for getting in this whole business came about by looking at this wonderful data that came out of the University of Chicago back in the late 80s. And this is a slide from Zhang Wu's thesis in 1991. It shows Nusselt versus Rayleigh over a large range of Rayleigh numbers. And this is so in a very large cell with a height of 0.4 meters, was 0.2 meters in diameter, so it's an aspect ratio half, so it looks like a soup can. And this was used to get very high Rayleigh numbers, so 10 to the 14 in those days was a very high Rayleigh number to get to. What Wu found and others at the University of Chicago, including in larger aspect ratio cells, was the single power law seemed to fit the data quite well. That wasn't so remarkable at the time. But what was remarkable was the value of the exponent. And so what is quoted in his thesis is an exponent of 0.290. And that didn't agree with the prevailing exponents of the time, the theoretical exponents, which would be one-third, based on some marginal stability arguments by Priestley and Malkus and Howard and others, or one-half predicted by Craiknin. So it was very, very exciting, these results, seeing this sort of scaling and trying to understand what was going on. Bernard Castaing, of course, was intimately involved in those experiments at that time, and since went to Grenoble. And so this is a plot due to his student, Siobhan. And again, this is another cryogenic helium experiment. In this case, the height is half of that. It's 0.2 meters, 0.1 meter in diameter. So again, the aspect ratio is kept at a half, the tall cell. Again, it's there are some liquid data points in here, but by and large, they're helium gas measurements. And you've already seen this plot. It's the 2/7 power law is superimposed on this data. But you see that the way it's represented here, at 10 to the 11th, there seems to be a transition, and in fact, if you were to fit this last little bit, you find the some sort of exponent of about 0.4. And so this is attributed to a transition to this ultimate scaling of Craiknin at very high Rayleigh numbers. Now, the question that occurred in Wu's case was whether one had gone to high enough Rayleigh numbers to see this transition. If this transition indeed could be seen. So this experiment was very exciting, and I think it's very intriguing that this occurs. What one notices, though, is that there are two nominally identical experiments. In other words, the Prandtl number is essentially the same in these for most of the range, certainly up to this point. The aspect ratio is the same. They're using the same fluid, yet they get such different and I should say significantly different the results. So this was a big question, and it added actually further motivation for our work. And how to understand all this. So we might think about what the Nusselt number would depend on. We certainly would believe it's a function of Rayleigh number, maybe a function of Prandtl number as well, of aspect ratio gamma. And there are other things, for instance, roughness would affect the Nusselt numbers. How well it satisfies Boussinesq conditions would be another thing to consider. But if you consider that you have smooth walls, you fix all these things up, have a constant Prandtl and gamma, then the old thinking would have been that we would expect a simple single power law to explain, to relate the Nusselt number to the Rayleigh number with exponents that are listed here, a 1/3 and the 1/2 I've talked about. 2/7 came about from work by Castang and Kadanoff and others at Chicago and Schramm and Sigia. And various other things, 0.3 plus log corrections by Paul Roberts and Stewartson. And the quarter and the fifth. Okay, so I. So at any rate, there's a wide variety, including superpositions of single power laws. And in fact, experiments can hope to find some contact with theory if they choose the proper theory to compare to. So our idea, then, in an experiment is to build a very large cell. The ones, the Wu's was 0.4 meters, so we decided to build one that was 1 meter tall. This would allow us to get to very high Rayleigh numbers, but keep the Prandtl number constant of about 0.7 over the range at which we see this transition in the French experiments. And also we'll keep the aspect ratio the same. So we're going to try to keep these the same and go to higher Rayleigh numbers yet, and also keep it the Boussinesq approximation well satisfied in that range where the previous measurements were made. Yeah, yeah. Pardon? Okay, granted. Upper bound. Right. Okay. Okay. It needs to be
Well, it's actually possible to do simulation in the infinite Prandtl number limit.
Well, actually, there's some work by Tumura. Is that how you pronounce his name? Tumura. I think this Prandtl number about 3 was considered infinite in this. So who knows? Any rate. Okay, well, I won't debate the relative merits of these various theories. That's not our job. We'll just show you what our results are. This is a schematic picture of our apparatus. It's very basic low-temperature apparatus. The cell itself is here. It says 1 meter tall, half a meter in diameter. This flange just allows us to break it apart and make a smaller aspect ratio cell. Otherwise, don't worry about that. It's filled with cryogenic helium gas. And the gas is formed by, we take liquid from a bath, which is up here, and through a valve and a filter to fill the cell and evaporate it and make a gas at a given pressure, which we can measure here, and measure the mean temperature. We have to measure temperatures, we have germanium resistance thermometers embedded in top and bottom copper plates. There's the top plate. Then these plates are separated. This can is a stainless steel, thin wall stainless steel can. The conditions at the bottom are one of a fixed heat flux. The heaters at the bottom are actually metal film heaters. They extend over the entire surface of the bottom plate. They're some serpentine pattern, as we've used for many years. And they're glued on with a low-temperature glue. And then additionally, they're sandwiched on with another copper plate. And in fact, the whole patterns, the electrode design around the whole patterns is designed to keep the heating uniform. So there are identical heaters at the top and the bottom. At the top, we control the plate to a fixed temperature, and we do that by we dump the heat out of the cell into the bath, and then we control by a servo mechanism up here. Now, the unusual feature of our apparatus is that the heat link between the top plate and the bath is done by another convection cell, which we call the soft vacuum heat transfer, and this is a manner of making it tunable. So we can vary the amount of heat we actually have to apply to the top plate to keep regulation. So what I don't show here are a number of semiconductor temperature probes, about 250 micron cubes, very similar to what Wu and Kastang's group used. And these we have these in the center and along the sidewalls for measuring temperature fluctuations and like the previous talk, we measure velocities by looking at the time correlation between two closely spaced sensors near one of the walls. So just to give you an idea of what this thing looks like, this is actually a picture when it was being constructed. This is the 1 meter tall sail. These are the copper plates. I should mention the copper plates were annealed to increase their conductivity, and they also, we can measure the smoothness down to, it's better than 10 microns, which means it's hydrodynamically smooth for the Rayleigh numbers that we are working over. So this is the actual sail. This is the helium reservoir. These plates here mount various radiation shields. The whole thing is surrounded by a vacuum to isolate it from the room. And so let me give you the measurement protocol. So the way we make measurements, again, we have, I should say something about our semiconductor probes. These are neutron transmutation doped. They're very uniformly doped semiconductors, which means we can take a large crystal and cut it up into small pieces, and they have identical sensitivities. So these are, again, 250 microns, and we have small brass leads attached. So I've already talked about the boundary conditions. Let me say how we adjust the Rayleigh number. There are three methods in this gas. The crudest the step is to just change the gas density. And the next step is to change the operating temperature, the mean temperature of the cell. And the mean temperature is defined as the average between the top and the bottom plate temperatures. And to get finer control yet, we make small changes in the applied heat flux. So delta T's are typically 100 to 500 millik. And density variations are quite large. The lowest density we used was about 2 times 10 to the minus 6 grams per cubic centimeter. And then we went up to near the critical density, which is 0.076. That's not the critical density, but that's the highest. Waiting times for equilibrium, that really depended on the Rayleigh number where we were as far as how vigorous the convection was. It also depends on the heat capacity of the enclosed fluid, but they're typically the order of an hour. What we did in practice was continually record the approach to equilibrium, and which is exponential, and the minimum we would wait would be some 5 characteristic times, but this is all determined empirically for each point, but it was something of order an hour for almost all Rayleigh numbers. The other thing to, as pointed out by Bernard in his talk, we do have to make a correction for the adiabatic gradient. So these, what the delta T's we actually measure are corrected for this. This is subtracted off, and that, in our case, is about 2 to 3 millikelvin. So it's out of 100 millik, then it's about a 2% correction. And it gets larger in our case because it depends linearly on L. So these are the main heat transfer results. And this is mainly what I want to talk about. So these are the Nusselt numbers we've measured versus the Rayleigh number. We measure down to 10 to the 6th in Rayleigh number and up to 10 to the 17. And over this range, we can fit that blue line there. The least squares fit to all the data, and it gives us the relation up here where the Nusselt number is proportional to Rayleigh to 0.309. That precision results just from that fitting procedure. So what can we say about this? Well, we can look at normalized plots, so that's in this lower insert here. So this is the fit. So it's Nusselt number normalized by Rayleigh to the 0.309. We can look at 2/7, and you'll notice that locally at low Rayleigh numbers, 2/7 works okay. But over the entire range, it's not a good fit, so we rule out 2/7 as explaining this data, unless one really wants to look very locally. Again, 1/3 also can be ruled out. For some odd reason, maybe it's just good fortune, it's a 0.3 plus log correction result of Paul Roberts and Stewartson works equally well as our 0.31 exponent of power law. And so at any rate, 2/7 and 1/3 don't seem to explain this data. We can look here at what the Prandtl number is doing and also some measure of the Boussinesqness. And here we take the criterion that was adopted by the French group in their JLTP paper, that alpha delta T alpha is the the expansion coefficient. So this is really a measure of the fractional change of density across the cell. And we see it's relatively constant up to about 10 to the 14 or so, as is the Prandtl number. Now both effects increase at the same Rayleigh number. So in some sense, it's hard to distinguish between Prandtl and Boussinesq effects. And you'll see at the end of the data stream, there is a bit of a turnover locally. And now whether, okay. We've really stuck with this, but we haven't in detail looked at that at their criterion. What we have done is, this is a plot of Nusselt number, again, versus Rayleigh number, and also the Prandtl number. So again, this is the Prandtl number is relatively constant, it's 0.7, say up to roughly up to 10 to the 13, then it starts going up, it goes up to a maximum of about 30 at 10 to the 17. So there's a steep increase in Prandtl number at the very end of our data series. Now what I've done here is taken the Nusselt numbers up to say 10 to the 13, where the Prandtl number is really very constant, and fit those. And we still we get a power law of 0.306, so really the Prandtl number in this region of constant Prandtl number did not change that exponent all that much, and this sort of weak, if there is any Prandtl effect there, they're certainly very weak, and this is, I think, consistent with what's going on at Santa Barbara and also in Ecke's experiments. Well, the other the issue is that although we don't see 2/7 and 1/3, certainly we've got something in between, and it's a bit different than what they had seen in Chicago. So to try to unravel some of these differences, we considered the fact that we're the fluid properties being used in these experiments, and in fact, we have used the properties of helium gas put out by NIST in 1992, so-called NIST-12 database. This was adopted then as the international standard for helium properties. And by and large, all properties have remained the same, with one notable exception, and that's the thermal conductivity. So the blue squares are the McCarty's tables, or the so-called MDS Note 631, which was published in 1972. These are the values that Wu had used in his experiment. Now we're using these, so you see there's actually a sizable shift between 5 and 10% in thermal conductivity. Now the first order effect of this is simply a shift in Nusselt number. It affects both the Nusselt and the Rayleigh, but by and large it's simply a shifting of the curve upward from what Wu had got. Now let's this is the one atmosphere isobar. I should mention that. So this is the function of temperature at one atmosphere. There's many more at other, right, there's temperature. So all this is has a temperature and pressure dependence. I'm showing as an example a one atmosphere isobar. So I'll go into detail about what that really means. But at any rate, the first order effect is simply a shift. Now you might ask, well, what is the effect on scaling of this change in accepted values of conductivity? Well, the scaling will change as a fractional change in this conductivity. It changes as a function of Rayleigh number, this conductivity again is a function of temperature and pressure. So what I show here, let me explain what this is. These are data taken from Wu's thesis. These are, I plot here the lambda MBS, is just the conductivity lambda that he used as a function of temperature and pressure for each Nusselt-Rayleigh point, and I subtracted off the modern properties and divided by his. So it's a fractional change as a function of Rayleigh number. So as Wu changed the Rayleigh number in his cell, he changed temperature and pressures, and we've plotted this fractional change in the conductivities as a function of the Rayleigh number then. So this dotted line is simply a guide to the eye, and what you get from this is as the fractional change is relatively constant, around 0.7 or 7%, up to about 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 11, then it starts increasing. So if there are any change in scaling, you would expect the changes in scaling to occur at sort of the upper end of Wu's experimental values. Well, we did recalculate Wu's data. This is an aspect ratio half cell. So we recalculated with the new properties of helium, and specifically with the thermal conductivity, which changes quite a bit. And we also made a small correction for adiabatic gradient, which Wu didn't make, but actually, in all fairness, is a very small correction in his case. So this is the Nusselt then as a function of Rayleigh with the recalculated values. And if we fit from 5 times 10 to the 7th, where this turbulence is presumably developed, we now have the scaling relation for that data. So it's the new exponent would be 0.299. So it's significantly different than the 0.290 plus or minus 0.005 that Wu reported. So this does have some effect on what one determines the scaling to be. And this so this whole mess has to be sorted out in some fashion. Pardon? Oh yeah, I made that. I didn't bring it. That it does increase it. They do lie above. Is that what you're talking about? Sorry, I don't have a compensated plot for this. I don't have the compensated plot.
I don't understand the answer. So the corrected Nusselt number plot could be with what you measure, or is there some ratio?
Well, this is the same aspect ratio, and it's not agreeing, but it's closer. It's shifted. Oh, the prefix. It does match up reasonably, but it's not. It's around something like 5% shift, and you notice this does shift up. So it's that part of it's a very small. Well, the prefactors change. It's shifted it up. I should have plotted that. I'm sorry I didn't plot it. Maybe. I should plot it up. I'm sorry. Okay, so let me then put this complicated plot on. So this is we've taken all these experiments and some others, and let me explain what this is. We're looking at the local, and this will give some insight into what happens to the scaling of Wu's data in particular, but we look at the local scaling exponents. What I mean by local scaling exponents, we take 3-decade-long intervals of Rayleigh number, we fit that, find the effective exponent, and plot it versus the Rayleigh number at the middle of that interval. Now, for some of these data, there some of these groups there aren't 3 decades. In that case, we use 2 decades. But at any rate, that's the spirit of this exercise. So what do I want to show you here? The open squares are our data. And you see there's a local variation of the slopes. I think all the data you see here have some sort of increase in slope of the Nusselt curve initially. There is some local variation, but if one averages over the entire Rayleigh range to zeroth order, you find that it's a And in our case, it's a single exponent. I think that's the best way to represent it in that case. Now I plot Wu's data here as well. That's the large open circles in red. And the smaller diamonds plotted along with it in red are the recalculated data of Wu. See, there's essentially no correction up to 10 to the 11th, and that agrees with what we discussed before about the thermal conductivity. Now, above that, you see the recalculated values start approaching. They are actually lower, yes. So this plot actually shows that. Now, there's also a bit of a droop, and this droop occurs in their experiment and occurs in ours, and if we plotted the non-Boussinesq points of Chavon, we'd see that too. So these are the points of out of Chavon's thesis. Everything agrees here. There's actually a monotonic increase in local scaling exponent, and then this is this transition, which was observed and talked about. And you see that even though there's some cloud of points here, this is certainly significantly higher. So what they observe is truly a phenomena that stands out from other measurements. Now I've plotted other. Okay. Well, yes, and I think this shows that there's a very close agreement between you and Wu. Yes, okay. Yeah, no, I think that's very clear right here, that between Wu's experiments and yours, there's very, very close agreement, up to 10 to the 10. And then 10 to the 11 is where this transition is seen, and that there's clearly very... Okay. Ah. Well, these are, that's a good point. These are mainly helium experiments, except for, which I haven't got to yet, measurements of Gunter's group at Santa Barbara, which are in acetone. And these are Prandtl number 4 or so. I've included them on this plot, and also some water experiments, just one point. But by and large, the experiments here are all Prandtl number 0.7, except the very highest. Pardon? I haven't got to that either. Let me get to this dotted line here, because that's the work of Victor Steinberg, which appeared in PhysRev Letters recently. I don't have access to that data, so I couldn't do this local exponent procedure. But what I've done is plot. They find an exponent of 0.3 and plus or minus 0.03 at constant Prandtl number, say Prandtl number 1. So I plotted that as just a dashed line, and this is the associated error bar. And actually, it appears the error bar really reflects in some way the overall cloud of points that we see here. And that also shows that this transition observed is really significant, that it's outside this. Okay, so those are the SF6 measurements, and also the Santa Barbara group's measurements, which agree very well, again, with this idea of an increasing, these are actually two different aspect ratios, aspect ratio half and aspect ratio 1. But again, they show this locally increasing scaling. Okay. All right. So yeah, the Prandtl number is increasing at the end of these runs. Okay. But the point I want to make is that there is some local variation. There's local variation in our slope. It's not a constant power law, but we take it zeroth order. We just draw a straight horizontal line. Okay, so let me just touch briefly on velocity measurements, because I guess time is running out. Yeah, yes. Point 309. I'll call it 0.31. So our data, I will assert, are consistent with a single power law exponent. Oh, okay. Well, let me talk about some velocity measurements we made. So we essentially have the same method that Bernard talked about. We take two closely spaced probes near the sidewall, measure the time correlation between them. In this case, we use we do use windowing. We have a window which is roughly a convection turnover time. Let me show the plots later of the velocity. This is the Rayleigh number. What we've noticed, the salient features, is that low Rayleigh number, we have a unidirectional flow, if that is what we're measuring. We measure one velocity in one direction. At high Rayleigh numbers, this changes quite a bit. We actually get a bimodal flow. And at some intermediate Rayleigh numbers, we start getting some mixing, but mainly still in one direction. So this is at 10 to the 10 Rayleigh number. And if one were to plot the velocity, it looks very uninteresting, except for the sharp spikes. But by and large, this is the 7 centimeters per second, so that's the average velocity measure. There's occasionally small blips of plus 7 centimeters per second. And the situation gets a little more clear when we go to higher Rayleigh number. So here's a couple of decades above, nearly 10 to the 12 in Rayleigh number. The velocity in this case is 5 centimeters per second, both plus and minus, and you see it's more evenly distributed. Again, this is a windowing time, which is roughly a convection turnover time. Yep. These are measured near the sidewall. No, this is actually about one quarter up from the. We're closer to the wall, but not we're not nearly one third. These are two temperature probes which are close together, about a centimeter apart. Well, actually, we have several. They're a centimeter, 2 centimeters, and down to a minimum of 3 millimeters. Which is roughly 10 times the size of the sensor. That's the sort of the minimum spacing. And we've compared these with the various, and it agrees quite well. If you look at various distances between the sensors, you get the same results. And also they're flipped in direction, so the signs are always consistent. Oh, right. Yeah, this is right. Okay, so let me. I wasn't going to discuss. Most of our experiments were done in aspect ratio 1/2. That's the Nusselt numbers I showed. We've done some preliminary measurements in aspect ratio 1. Now we've had some problems with this, as we had a leak. It was a small leak, but it's nonetheless the Nusselt numbers were a bit ambiguous. But it was we certainly could. Could stabilize a Rayleigh number and measure velocities. So we've done some program to measure velocities. I'm just showing that data here. In fact, since I have 10 minutes, let me go back. Because, okay, it won't take me that long. I didn't mention this, but let me put these on. Even though we've corrected, these are all preliminary data. I even mentioned that. They've been corrected for a heat leak, because we did have leak helium into the vacuum space, and you now you've got a parallel nonlinear heat transport. But these are these open diamonds, and these are the local exponents. So they actually look even much more like Wu's results. But again, these are very preliminary, and I hesitate to make too much of this data until we get it fixed, and hopefully it's being fixed right now as I'm sitting here. So these velocities I'm going to show you are out of an aspect ratio 1 cell. We also did this exercise. This is aspect ratio 1/2, so we see the same thing. At 10 to the 6, it's all one direction. 10 to the 5th, or 10 to the 13th, it's bimodal. So nothing has changed between aspect ratio half and aspect ratio one, qualitatively. Okay, well let me get to that. So I'll show it on the next slide. So this is then the bimodal distribution, which has measured velocities in both directions, and roughly, in this sort of histogram, roughly equal counts over this time series that we've extracted this from. And this is a picture, a plot of the velocity as a function of time, again with the same window, which is, and the restrictions on the window are the same ones that I mentioned. If you make the window too small, you don't have the precision. If you make it too big, you're going to average over these events. So this is the velocity, how it looks. So minus 5 and plus 5 centimeters per second, you see it's switching, but it's not switching in any periodic way. There are some short jumps, some rather long excursions where it's one or the other, and again, some short jumps in between. So this is really a mystery to us, what this represents. Now, one of the possibilities is that if there is some mean circulation, this relates to the work of Chiliberto and Cioni and all. I think this was this particular paper. Pardon? Oh, the new one. Okay, well, that's an old slide. But at any rate, if there's some tilt, one can stabilize the convection in some direction. If one takes the tilt away, then these rolls tend to oscillate or drift azimuthally around. Now, it's possible that these we have some mean circulation, which is simply drifting around. We're seeing maybe the positive upflow or the downflow at various times. It's really... That's true. It doesn't, Okay. All right. Bob talked about actually the possibility in a recent email message right before I left, having two cells, or maybe more, which he sees in simulations. Is that right? Okay. So he never sees one. Well, maybe you'll talk about this. Okay. Right. Right. Well, right. Well, that's the difference. So we see this both in aspect ratio half and in aspect ratio one, that this is switching between two signs. Now this is. Yeah. Well, I mean that. Yeah. Okay. Now this is there aren't a lot of statistics to go into this plot, but I'll just put it up because somebody will ask anyway. So if I just take the various, and we haven't done a lot in this cell because it finally did break completely and we lost all our vacuum. So, but before that happened, we were able to take a number of velocity measurements of various Rayleigh numbers. And so I've plotted them multiplied by the height of the cell. That's the length scale. And I've made a Reynolds number out of this. And with these few points, I get a fit, which is, you see it here, it's a square root behavior. But again, the statistics are a little lacking. But what you should take from that is the velocity is essentially constant over all Rayleigh number. And what's really varying here is the kinematic viscosity. All right, so let me summarize. I guess I'm close to all right, so we've in an aspect ratio half cell, which looked very much like Chicago experiment and the one at Grenoble, we've made measurements over 11 decades of Rayleigh number, okay, so up to 10 to the 17. I'm going to say to zeroth order, we see that a single power law works well to describe this data. Although locally, we see variations in the exponent. The other point to stress is that we've maintained essentially constant Prandtl number and Boussinesq and good satisfaction of the Boussinesq conditions over the range in which previous measurements were made, up to Rayleigh numbers, say, of 10 to the 14. We've looked at the changes in the accepted values of thermal conductivity, so I showed you the effect on Wu's experiments of that. And the other key point is we don't see any transition, regardless of what our exponent is. We're not seeing a transition to any different kind of scaling at high Rayleigh number, in particular, scaling characterized by an exponent of a half. And at low Rayleigh, velocities are unidirectional. They switch directions at high Rayleigh numbers, and I think the Prandtl number effects in our experiment are rather weak. And that's, let me just conclude there. How do you do, boss?
Of course. Let's continue the conversation.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask Donna and Joe plot the trajectories of the experiments in that Prandtl Valley space. At some point after, before lunch.
Oh, sometime, okay. So somebody has to put a scale on the, now that depends on all the, now let's decide on all the experiments we're going to have and we'll make the proper abscissa. Sorry. Oh, I see. Well, it depends on, I'm not sure how big an effect the Prandtl number really is in all this. But I don't know what to, I guess I don't know what to insert. Right, so you're talking about some scheme where we could minimize... Yeah.
Bill? I would add my voice to that. I sent you a paper about a year ago.
Well, that was you. Well, we can look at... Sure, I'll give you another copy. Well, you know, these theories are coming fast and furious. 11 years old. Okay. Well, maybe we should talk and hash over this data again. That's right. Yeah, you'll embarrass me publicly, and now I'll have to. Next time I talk, I'll come with a slide. There are some differences in the way the cells are constructed, the way the heat is taken out of the top plates, for instance, or how the temperatures are measured. It looks like the conductivities are roughly the same of the materials. We made some crude measurements in situ of conductivity, which are very close to what you did by measuring, by not having gas in that space and measuring gradients. So we get something of order 1500 or up to 2000 watts per meter Kelvin. So this is all consistent with annealed copper. It's nothing very special. Yeah.
Yeah.
I should mention we find a reasonable agreement with Loess's kind of scaling. It's not something that will convince us that a single power law does not work even better, but it's I think there's some reasonable agreement with the two power laws, 1/3 and 1/4, that should apply to our data. So this is also something to consider.
Okay. Why don't we take that?
Russ coach you on how to respond to some question about differences in
I know, it's obvious.
Okay, so we're going to have lots of
all the experiments.